Good morning and welcome to Green Zine here at WFVR-LP South Royalton. Let's sing along with Little Birdie and then we'll jump into Green Zine. That is Lily Mae Ledford, recorded towards the end of her career, one of the original Coon Creek girls. And wow, can she hit that clawhammer banjo. I enjoyed a lot of old-time music down at the Green Mountain Bluegrass and Roots Festival. So that was Little Birdie with Lily Mae Ledford. Just about to join Henry in a moment here on Green Zine, whether you're listening on a Thursday morning or our very early morning. I think it's on Monday morning at 6 p.m., the rebroadcast. But we do have a replay. If you missed part of the show or you want to catch at another time, just go to WFVR.org, hit the replay tab, and look for Green Zine. Green Zine is brought to you today by a new underwriter, Imagine Zero Music Festival. We talked with one of the co-founders of that event last week, Ben Cogan. It is going on September 7th out at Fable Farm. It's all about great music, mostly from Vermont, and sustainability, really trying to keep that carbon footprint just about down to zero, thus the Imagine Zero tag. Soloflect, actually, Soloflect is in touch with Imagine Zero. Who knows? Maybe we'll see Soloflect out there at that event on the 7th. Bale, longtime supporter of the radio station, building a local economy. Find out more about them at balevt.org. Tom Wells and his business, Royal Trailworks. Daniel Leibowitz, who participated in our 3P11, yeah, the 11th pedal power to the people, giving us some additional funds with his registration fee. The Upper Pass Beer Company, the First Branch Coffee Company, both those businesses located very close to here. Solar Fest, and we just got an update. They are really getting things ready for relaunching their festival in the summer of 2025. The White River Land Collaborative's having a food and art gathering this coming Sunday, starting at 4 p.m. out at the Collaborative. And finally, a breakfast and lunch establishment in Randolph that's called Wit and Grit. Henry, are you full of wit and grit today?
Oh, I hope so.
Yeah, I know so.
Good.
Yeah.
I'm for it.
All
wit
right.
And grit. Good combo.
It is. Yeah, I just had a little snack, so I'm well fed, and we'll try to provide a little bit of wit. So what do we have on tap today, Henry?
Yes, well, we have a little bit of a collection today.
Okay.
We're going to take a kind of a deep dive into thinking about some of the very high performance heat pumps and how utility companies currently have time of day rates, at least Green Mountain Power does, and some of the others do too. I think probably all of them have something. and that their real cost of electricity is probably way more than the difference that they're currently offering you. And by going to a high performance, basically a hot water heater, but it is a heat pump that will heat hot water, and it can heat it to a higher degree than a regular standard heating and cooling heat pump does. And by doing that, you can store energy in the form of hot water in your house, and use it when the grid is charge it when the grid is cheap, and use it when the grid's expensive, and save money on your power bill.
Sounds good.
We'll get into looking at that one.
Yeah.
And there's also been events. I went to a very interesting conference last night that D.D. Pursehouse had put together with an Australian farmer. And so we will check in on the power of diversity, which is basically what he was capturing on his farm. And there will be a link up for that, so you can go and view that if you want to take a deeper dive into that, or if you want to send people who are farming that you know to it. It was heavily attended by farmers worldwide, all asking interesting questions.
Wow.
And then we have kind of a calendar event, some more things that have to do with resiliency and the climate, a Stratford event for this coming Saturday. And we'll get into EVs, I guess, a bit as well.
Yeah, and we'll touch on some news that affects the towns of Bethel and, let's see, who else was in there? Royalton and Tunbridge, and I think maybe Chelsea. So we'll get to some local tidbits of interest that the Energy Committee made a presentation in Bethel about EV chargers. So we'll get to that a little bit later. But usually, Henry, we do start out with a bird note. Should we do that today?
I think we should have bird note. The birds are out there, and I picked this one, even though it's a very recent one. Someone may have already heard it, but I picked this one because here in Burlington, we're able to feed our birds year-round without having the bears get attracted to the bird feeders.
They're not waltzing down Church Street yet, the bears?
It may happen. We have gotten away with feeding all summer long for a number of years, and the amount of bird activity at the feeders, just nonstop, all the feeders full of birds all the time, is just a real indication of what this bird note's all about.
Right. They might be getting, getting pretty fat, those birds.
Yeah, they're stocking up for a big flight somewhere.
All right, here we go with Bird Note. You're listening to Green Zine here at Royalton Community Radio.
This is Bird Note. Long-distance migration requires metabolic feats that dazzle the mind and lots of fat. Tiny blackpoll warblers double their weight in the lead-up to migration. Wilson's phalaropes may put on so much fat that they actually have to lose weight to get their fat-loaded bodies into the air. Chubby bar-tailed godwits, normally very strong flyers, may need a long-running start to take off. To store fat, birds may eat three times as much and forage over many more hours than normal as they prepare for long-distance travel. To process so much chow, a bird's stomach and intestines must physically grow in size. A bird's liver, the organ that turns nutrients into fats, might triple in size. At the cellular level, equally impressive changes make it possible for a bird to draw energy from all that fat during long flights. These include changes in fatty acids, plus a big bump in the protein molecules that move fats through the bloodstream. And there's a surge in enzymes that hand off the fat to the muscles, thus fueling the strenuous work of flight. If long migratory flights are amazing, what goes on inside a bird's body during those flights seems absolutely astonishing. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
There you have it, Bird Note.
You know, it's quite incredible, the power of nature, the things that nature does to adapt itself to situations. And I'm that presentation I went to last night about the Australian farmer and what he'd done with his farm. He was turning on nature, and you know, this Bird Note is pointing that that nature has the ability to just change the system around and make it work. And it's just an ongoing theme in my mind that that we need to embrace that power of nature. It's just so powerful, and we tend to want to just take from nature and not kind of work with nature. Right. And I think that working with, we don't have to go crazy trying to protect nature, although that might be all right. but we certainly need to use it to our benefit, to unlock that its strengths, and instead of just trying to come out with the short-term gain for the cheapest thing.
Well, I think one thing that,
my little diatribe.
Well, I'll do a shorter diatribe, and that is that, you know, just by being present, we live in a very rural state, as do many other residents of the United States, and that gives us a little bit more opportunity to be present and observe things that are going on in nature. For instance, yesterday, we have a little stone step that we built down a short hill, and I was just about to take a step, and there was a small, rarely dark, almost black toad. And we don't see as many toads and frogs and hear them as much as we used to. The spring peepers are not quite as loud, but just making note of those things, I think, is kind of a, even though things are diminishing at a rapid rate, we're trying to reverse that, it gives you a little hope, a little optimism by communing with nature. We'll just put it that way.
Yes, indeed. So, black toad.
Yeah, a little black toad, only about, maybe not even quite an inch long, maybe more like a half inch.
Oh, I have seen one of those some of the year, maybe 2 or 3 years ago.
Okay.
But that sounds like a rarity.
let's do some research on that maybe for the next show. We'll play a toad song, Toad in a Bucket. I already have the song picked out, Henry, and now we'll find out what kind of toad that was. Yeah.
That's a deal. We need a toad expert. We'll have to put that on the list for bring someone in that can walk us through the whole world of toads.
I'm sure there's one somewhere. You know who could tune us into a toad specialist is the Center for Eco Studies down in Norwich. I bet you if we get a hold of somebody down there, they can talk about toads.
I will put that on my list.
Yeah, you got a pretty long list there, Henry. And we've got quite a list of things to get to today. I'm going to mention one thing before we go. I think we might be going to an audio clip, but I want to, this will be posted at our notes page. And we have interviewed this gentleman, and he has been in business for like 50 years. I'm talking about Dave Chapman of Longwood Organic Farm and Longwood Real Organic. Longwind Real Organic Tomatoes. So I'm just reading a little bit from this story. They are a nationally recognized brand. They're available all throughout the Northeast. He started this Longwind farm all the way back in the late 70s. He began growing vegetables with a pair of oxen on 1 acre. Route 113 in Thetford. He's still over there. He drew on a year of experience working with someone that we know, Henry, or at least I know him through Jim Rooney. Celebrated organic farmer Jake Guest of Killdeer Farm in Norwich was part of his mentoring. And they sold a roadside stand and on. So it's a very good article, and we'll have it posted at our website. And maybe... what's that?
Tim Sanford of
Luna Blue. Did he get started?
Luna Blue Farm actually was the person that certified him.
Aha! Uh-huh. There you go. Wow. There's some. It that's real local history. Yeah, Luna Blue Farm's only about a mile and a half from the studio. Very close. Yeah. So maybe a little bit more, but you can read all about Dave here in this article. All right, Henry. What's up next?
So. I think I'm for diving into the to this cooling heat pump or heating heat pump. It's really for heating. Piece. It's a longer program. It's part of an hour podcast from Volts, and Volts dips into one thing after another, looking at ways to get off of fossil fuel is their biggest focus, and all the things that restrict us from doing that. The electric grid, which we plan to do a program with, I think next week, with someone who is arguing for public participation in decisions about how the grid should work and where our energy sources come from across all of New England, and how that's currently kind of an inside job by the utility companies and the public service boards, and the public really isn't given a chance to weigh in a significant way. They can comment, but they don't have to be paid attention to. And so we will get into that and why we should care about it. And so this Volts podcast is from a California company. So husband and wife that had a house that they were heating with an oil furnace and or a gas furnace, but something that was fossil fuel, and they wanted to convert it. And they realized they did a deep dive into it, and they both had education that helped them unpack this. And they decided, hey, we can not only do this for ourselves, but we can make a business out of it. And they make a brain, a box with all the controls in it to control everything that's going on in the house in the way of heating your hot water, heating your house, cooling your house, interacting with utility grids so that you are making use of the low cost power rates when power is basically rattling around in their system with no one to use it, and then avoiding using it when it's expensive for the power company.
Right.
And we'll comment after we hear this about our need to push the utility companies to have better time-of-day metering available if we want to make use of it.
Yeah. So,
let's listen to this and try and understand it. I'll try to reiterate some of these key points once you've heard. This is just a short 7 minutes out of an hour program.
Yeah, we're going to get this rolling. And just to acknowledge, I might give another little tag at the end of the recording, but this was written by David Roberts for the podcast Volts back in June of this year. Heat pumps with thermal batteries right here on Green Zine at Royalton Community Radio.
Hello, everyone. This is Volts for June 26th, 2024. Heat pumps with thermal batteries. I'm your host, David Roberts. As listeners have no doubt figured out by now, I am extremely excited about heat pumps, which are the main way we are going to decarbonize home heating and cooling. Heat pumps are not just one thing, though. There are many different kinds for many different purposes and building types, using many different materials and fluids, trying out many different innovations. I am not going to turn Volts into a heat pump podcast, as tempting as it is, but I do want to cover at least some of these varieties. Last month, I had Paul Lambert from the startup Quilt on the pod to talk up the merits of heat pump mini splits for ductless heating and cooling. With a mini split system, there is an outdoor unit connected independently to several smaller freestanding wall units inside. Most houses, however, still have ducts, where a heat pump would typically replace a furnace as a source of warm air distributed by fans through the ducts. there's cool stuff going on in that area too, which brings us to today's guest, Harvest co-founder and CEO Jane Melia. Harvest does not make heat pumps exactly. It makes coordinators for systems of which a heat pump is a part. The idea is for a heat pump to run when electricity is cheap, often at night, storing its heat in a large water tank, aka a thermal battery. The water from that tank is used both for hot water and to heat the air in the home via an air exchanger. By shifting the timing of electricity consumption, Harvest claims its systems can save on both money and emissions. But I will let Melia describe the details. So, with no further ado, Jane Melia from Harvest, welcome to Volts. Thank you so much for coming.
Hi, David. It's a real pleasure to be here, and thanks for that introduction. I can't wait for our conversation.
First, let's get a bead here on Harvest. Sort of, where are you in the journey? I know you and your husband sort of had this wild hair idea several years ago to do this thing, and it's one of these old-fashioned started up in your basement startup ideas. Where are you now? Are you producing things, selling things to actual customers in actual markets? Like, what stage are you at?
So yeah, it's been quite a journey, and I'd love to tell you more about it. Yes, we are up and running. Our systems are sold in several hundred homes now. So we have lots of, you know, real customers who have no affiliation with the company, deploying our system and really loving it, right? We get great customer satisfaction, so... People talk about the net promoter score sometimes to try and measure, are we really meeting a customer's need? It's that response to the question, you know, would you recommend this this system to a neighbor or a friend? And we're close to 90%. And I guess what that really means is it works, right? You get hot water, your house is nice and warm, it's steady, it's easy to use, and you save money.
And this is in just California right now, or are we expanded beyond that?
It's primarily in California because that's where I'm sitting, right? So it makes sense to start your company where you are because, you know, that's where your reach is. And of course, we're a startup, we're a small team, and you've got to try and use your resources as efficiently as possible. But we're not just a California company. We do currently have systems in Oregon, in New Mexico, up in Edmonton, Alberta, ultra cold Edmonton, Alberta. And we expect to be deploying some more in the Northeast and in some of the colder states in the U.S. in the coming months.
Interesting. Okay, so let's talk about then what it is. What is the system? So maybe you could talk about it by way of talking about how you discovered the need for it. Sort of like what dilemma were you trying to solve when you came up with this? And what is the solution?
Absolutely. So the first dilemma was we had an old gas furnace, like many folks out there, right? Mm-hmm. Much of the heating and hot water heating in our homes in the United States is from burning gas, sometimes fuel oil, sometimes electric resistance. But we were in that case with many of the listeners where we had a gas furnace that was getting old. Now, I've been working in the clean energy space since 2008, in solar, in energy storage, in solar cells. And my husband also has been working in this space as well.
You're both engineers, right? Not like you weren't like working in customer service or something. You had your hands on machines.
We are both engineers, but we had both moved over to the business side, right? So I was really on the business development side. I did start off life as a civil engineer. I have a graduate degree in fluid mechanics. And one of my very first jobs was actually working on wind turbines a long way back. But, you know how life takes you in different directions. And so in those startups, I was firmly on the business side, which was a lot of fun. So what happened? So old gas furnace was about to die. We were not going to replace a gas furnace with another gas furnace. You know, we have to walk the talk. This is what we've been doing much of our careers. And so the thing was, well, let's put a heat pump in. And that's fine. You know, heat pumps are just magnificent devices. They're the heroes of building electrification, right? They're moving heat rather than generating it, as you know. Right. So much more efficient than anything else out there. But there is I'd say the dirty secret of heat pumps is that particularly for heating, they're going to add load to the grid at inopportune times. often when there's a peak demand, for example. So they tend to add load to the grid. They can also operate at times when they're least efficient. For example, you know, it's actually better to run a heat pump in the middle of the day for heating because it's going to run much more efficiently than if you have to run it at 5 a.m. And so we realize that if everybody shifts from gas to heat pumps as they are today, we'll all add a huge load to the grid at the morning and at nighttime. Yes. And that's really difficult.
And that is the famous duck curve, of course, the spike in demand in the morning. And then in the evening, just as the sun's going down, right? Like solar power is plunging downward right as everybody's cranking up their showers and their heat pumps and their stoves and stuff in the evening.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, you get this dilemma, you know, what do I do? Do we clean up our buildings and then add a load at night and in the morning? And then what's the grid going to do? Have to have peaker plants for those times.
Right.
Or do we clean up the grid?
Right.
And we had that problem where it's kind of this fratricidal battle. Do you do one or the other? And what Harvest is doing is saying, no, wait a minute. You can do both. Combine a high-performance heat pump water heater with some thermal storage and some really, really good controls. And you can run that heat pump whenever makes the most sense for the grid, whenever it's most efficient, and whenever it's going to save the most money. Store that heat in the thermal battery.
Right. And this is just a classic model that's popping up all over the place, right? You're just time shifting. You're saving the heat and using it later.
That's right. We're time shifting. And of course, the devil is in the details of how you do that to make sure you don't run out of water, to make sure you don't waste energy, to make sure you operate efficiently. But yeah, that's what it's all about, is time shifting, load shifting.
Well, speaking of time shifting, Henry, I'm stopping it right there at 8:07. Yeah. I know you might want to make some comments, and we may have time to continue with the remaining part of that to be decided. But I'll let you say a word where we are so far with this interesting thermal battery from a heat pump.
Yeah, so the concept here is that a hot water tank with really hot water in it, they work the water up at 150 degrees or thereabouts, and that has a lot of stored energy in it that can be used for heating the house or heating your hot water. And their units are heavily focused towards a house that's a ducted house, that the house already has central air ducts in it.
Mm-hmm.
There are probably ways to skin that same situation in a way that's kind of for an open floor plan house or something that might be able to be heated with a without ducts.
I see.
But the key concept here is two things. One is that our standard air-to-air mini splits or heat pumps that tend to go in Vermont for heating and cooling are not all that efficient when they get down to 10 degrees, 0, 10 below. They still work at 10 below, but the efficiency kind of goes to pieces. And the heat pump that they are working on with is what are now being sold in Vermont for just for hot water heat systems, for making hot water for your shower and utility hot water. And so they're going to that style, which doesn't use refrigerant as the cooler. It uses CO2. And the CO2 has a rating of 1. If it were to leak out, well, each pound of CO2 is another pound of CO2 in the atmosphere. When you have refrigerants that are in the mini splits that we're now tend to install for heating and for cooling, those refrigerants can be 300 to 1. Or even 1,000 to 1.
Ooh.
And my partner here in Burlington has mini splits in the house, and she's had it leak already.
Yeah.
So, and it's she's had it for about 4 years. And they didn't really get the leak fixed right the first time, so they came back the second time and even topped it up some more. And that's not good for the environment, but those style of heat pumps don't have the ability of taking hot water up to 150 degrees. They like warming at a much lower temperature, kind of good for warming air in a house, but not good for storing heat. And so the CO2 heat pumps take you down that road. And the lady is being interviewed there, and I've put a link to her website in the Green Team notes, is really focusing on selling the control box and developing a network of installers who know how to marry together the different systems. The disadvantage to her system CO2 heat pumps is they don't do any cooling. So if you want to have air conditioning, if you want to cool things off as the climate goes wildly out of control, which I think at some point we're all going to want to do, then you have to do that cooling as a separate operation. But for her situation in California, where they do have appropriate time of day metering, they can reduce your energy bill by at least a third over what running regular mini splits would do. So they make your bill go down, and they're good for the environment.
So a comment and a question, Henry. So the comment is, I noticed, I don't know if I was reading along with it, and she might have said this, or maybe it was in the intro, that she was talking about other places where these heat pumps with thermal batteries are located outside of California. She mentioned Edmonton, yes. But they also, the next jump within the lower 48 is to the Northeast, and it makes sense that if it's primarily good for heating water and providing thermal heat, maybe not so great for air conditioning. You're not going to, although she did have one down in New Mexico. That was interesting. That gets pretty warm down there. So that's kind of the comment. And then the question is, does this type of heat pump then, if you had it and it was being used for heat and for heating water, then you are going away from the normal gas-fired water heater entirely by using this system along with heat pumps?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
You're going away from gas-fired hot water heaters, and you're going away from resistance electric hot water heaters.
Yeah.
And so a heat pump in general is transferring heat rather than heating. So it's stealing heat from the outside and bringing it into your house. Mm-hmm. And in cold conditions, there's not a lot of heat out there, so you need a pretty efficient system to do that efficiently. And these CO2 jobs do that really nicely. They're built for that. And in industry, they're taking water up to, instead of 150 degrees, they're going all the way above 200 degrees, above boiling point.
Be careful.
This kind of CO2 heat pump has the ability to keep on going. The technology for going up to those high temperatures is not yet adapted to home use, but it's being used in industrial situations.
Mm-hmm.
And the more temperature you have in your hot water tank, the more hours of heat you can get out of it. It's basically the bottom line. So if someone had a baseboard hot water heat system in their house, I believe that you could use the CO2 heat pumps to generate the water to circulate in that. 180 degrees is what a gas furnace normally takes those to, and these are around 150. So they might be a little slower to heat up, but probably could be traded out immediately. So we have to, you know, we have to find some good contractors who understand it. And a bottom line thing on this is if you didn't hear the or didn't absorb the our program on the 8th of this month with Capstone Community Energy, you have to realize from that, go back and review that, there's a lot of financial help out there, and it is especially true for the people that are down in two times poverty level. But there is stuff going on up through all the way to people that are, you know, making $100,000 a year.
Yes,
and so some of the capital cost of this can be defrayed that way, and the installation cost. There's and it is a trade-off. You don't want to just throw money at putting a great big furnace in when you still have broken windows in the house. And it's important to tighten your house up because it makes the size of the units you're going to put in smaller. It makes the cost of those units go down because of that. It reduces the operating costs, and it increases the comfort that is in the house. So you land up with a lot of wins when you go in and do some thermal improvement to the building. So it's kind of a complicated way off because you look at each one and you can spend lots of money on each one, and there's a price balance to just how far do you go with tightening up your envelope, and how small a unit do you try to get to, or is it cheaper to be a little bit larger unit and do a little less in the house tightening up? And the house side of it, the real key to getting your heating and cooling bill low in a house is to make it much more airtight than it currently is.
Right.
And with the old construction, you'll never get it too tight, probably. But you need someone who knows what they're doing to help you with that.
So let's do some advanced planning on this, Henry. One, we should maybe keep in touch with this company, Harvest, out in California. And if we find out that indeed they have sold and there is an installed thermal storage unit using their special control box, and if that's somebody that we can talk to during the depths of winter, particularly if we do get down to zero or below zero, kind of get a report from them. And even if we don't find out about one of those units coming to New England this winter, talk to some of the folks that we do know that are using mini splits and traditional heat pumps and see how they're doing. If we get below zero, just get some feedback directly from those who are using this, because I've talked to people that say, oh boy, when we get down to 15 degrees above, I need to use a little bit of backup heat. But I've talked to someone who said, no, when it was 5 below, I didn't make any change, and the heat pump was just fine. So we'll try to get some on-the-ground information. Henry, we've got about 21 minutes left in the show. I don't know if you want to make one more comment on this subject, but we're gonna go to a little fracking piece in a moment.
Yeah, I just very quickly, I want to say, I think we had Bob Sierna on, and he's living in a house in Wilder that is entirely heated and cooled with heat pumps. And it is relatively new construction. It was designed to have heat pumps run it. But he says it's totally comfortable and his energy costs are low.
No.
And a lot of it is to do with that was, you know,
very
a
tight house.
Easy place
yeah.
to heat and cool to start with.
Really important. I might get back to another building that needs some tightening up that's a municipally owned building. Shall we go? We're going to go
to... They're all like that, those municipal ones.
Yeah,
they're all old.
Very leaky. Old and leaky. So we carry a show. It's a satire, but also some investigative journalism involved. Harry Shearer, noted comic and one of the voices on The Simpsons years ago. And he often has environmental stories, whether it's about fracking. He has a piece often called News of the Warm. I see that this week he had News of the Atom. But let's check in what's going down in Texas right now with fracking. Yes, and fracking is still with us, even with a change, possible change in administration. I don't think fracking's going away anytime soon. You're listening to Green Zine here at WFVR.
We've got the ultra-modern knack of getting oil. So give the boys just a bit of slack and say a hearty what the frack.
This summer, Texas has experienced over 1,000 earthquakes. A few of the stronger ones, magnitude 4 and above, made headlines in late July. A large number can be seen. It can seem to be staggering because Texas is known for earthquakes. Till now. Most cases, the earthquakes are small and can't be felt, but as years have passed, higher magnitude quakes have become more common. Quote, from the tectonic point of view, we don't expect earthquakes in the state of Texas, says Alexandros Savidis, seismologist and overseer of the TexNet earthquake catalog. He says Texas is located on the intraplate of the continent. Not supposed to see a lot of seismic activity, but quote, due to the changes in the stress state of the subsurface, we start having earthquakes. Now this is happening mostly due to oil and gas operations, quote, unquote. Two main ways this happens, saltwater disposal and fracking. During oil and gas drilling operations, saltwater is produced. To dispose of it, it's put back into the ground by way of a very deep well. You're welcome. The biggest preventive measure Savaitis proposes is that Texas may eventually benefit from a seismic code. Guidelines that protect buildings and people from earthquakes, similar to what California has in place. Yeah, it works well for us, babe. Check last week. India's plans to scale up fracking operations without robust regulations could spell disaster for the country's finely balanced water security, according to the research from the University of Surrey. Surrey has. India's positioning shale gas as a key transitional energy source has announced 56 fracking projects across six states. That's some transitional. Despite the promise of energy independence, Surrey's study raises alarm bells about the country's preparedness to handle the unique water risks posed by fracking. The process has been controversial worldwide due to its significant environmental impacts, particularly on water resources. Study points out India's regulatory framework for fracking is currently based on rules designed for ordinary drilling processes, which don't adequately address the distinct challenges presented by fracking. They are water contamination. Fracking fluids and the release of methane can contaminate groundwater supplies. Water usage. Fracking operations consume vast amounts of water, which can deplete local water supplies. Meaning, where's the water? Wastewater management, handling and disposing of the contaminated water that returns to the surface is a complex challenge. And, as in Texas, water-induced seismicity, the injection of fracking fluids can trigger earthquakes.
Well, let's pull that down in the mix right there. Yeah, there's a word you can just toss out. Seismicity, Henry. Have you had any earthquakes up there in Burlington?
No, we haven't, but Vermont does occasionally get an earthquake, and I think that the places where there's fracking going on and also removal of groundwater, as in the Great Plains states where yes. they are drafting the aquifer down, they are getting earthquakes there. And I might say about fracking that go back to it. I think one of the bright lights about fracking, or not about fracking, but no. about taming the problems of fracking, is the Environmental Defense Fund having been involved in putting up a methane satellite that would measure the
leakage.
Methane escaping yeah. from leakage from doing fracking. And that satellite is in gathering data, and they are they're in the process of gathering data and putting it together in ways that they can hand it to all the people who are actually causing that leakage. And methane is way, way more powerful as a greenhouse gas than CO2 is.
Yeah.
So it's a important thing, and they believe that the companies that are leaking are both going to be a little ashamed of doing the damage they're doing, but we'll also find, oh, gee, I'm wasting natural gas that I'm just spent money to get out of the ground. So we'll go around and tighten up a gasket or do something to improve that so it's better for our bottom line. And the early phases of that, which has been happening by land-based equipment already with them, but is going to move into this satellite-driven work, will in fact reduce some of that methane nasties that are going into the atmosphere.
So
I think down the road, I mean, if we were to do the trifecta in the election cycle here, I think that the EPA could be in there writing rules about capturing your methane when you're fracking and getting more serious about it than they currently are. All sort of flies under the, well, we're just generating energy for you folks.
So Henry, I'm going to put my climate cynic hat on. No future danger of corporate sabotage of those sensor satellites up there by fossil fuel interests.
Could happen.
It could happen.
But they're getting cheaper and cheaper. The launch.
They could just throw up another one. Yeah, it's getting kind of crowded up there.
Maybe
between
put up some stealth ones that the corporate interests don't know
that they can't even see. Yeah, huh. Yeah, that is something else. Okay, let's leave the fracking alone. Hopefully, no fracking. Although there may still be some frack gas getting into our system here in Vermont, even though there's no actual drilling happening in the state of Vermont. But lots of problems with that.
It's true.
Yep,
it's true.
Very true. Hey, let's touch base with someone who actually has been in the studio a couple times. She co-hosted the show a few years ago, and I'm talking about your friend Dee Dee Pursehouse. You went to a 2-hour presentation last night, but she's going to be giving another. Are heading up a presentation this coming weekend, very nearby, right in our neighborhood.
Yes, indeed. So that is a link to that in our show notes at the bottom of the main page. The little blue box says Green Scene Links, and that's going to be, I believe, in Stratford.
Yes,
and it is aimed. I knowing Dee Dee, I know some of the things she's going to talk about. She's looking at how to reduce the flood and the flood damage and extreme rain events, and I'm sure she will get it. It's really aimed at people like road crews and people like that, but it also up the general public. And I'm sure she'll get into if you can hold water on the land. So what we do right now is when we have water around, we say, well, let's figure out how to get it in the river, and let's figure out how to, you know, make it rush into the Long Island Sound or wherever it's going to land up as fast as possible. And she's going to talk about if you can make the land absorb the water and store the water, then you get less flood.
Yep, you get improved groundwater recharge, and you create cooling oases during heat waves. This is from the notice, and just so folks don't lose track of this, it is happening this Saturday, that's August 24th, over at Barrett Memorial Hall in South Stratford. Most local folks know exactly where that is. It's going to go pretty much a good part of the day. You're asked to bring a lunch. They'll provide some coffee and some snacks, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., and you could probably just show up. I think it's pretty loose, but to register officially, you go, it's being put on by the White River Conservation District. You would go to White River, NRCD. So White River and then NRCD .org and register for that. So looks like a fascinating program, Henry.
It does. I think it's, you know, I think this is very important stuff. It's stuff that really does have an opportunity to tame some of the things that we've unleashed with our burning of fossil fuels. So you had a little comment on electric vehicles, and I want to comment on them as well.
Okay, but just before turning on the battery in the electric vehicle, mine's getting charged right now. And don't forget, there is free level 2 charging here on the campus of the Vermont Law and Graduate School. I'm sure they don't mind me telling people that. Another great resource that we have in this area is Sustainable Woodstock. We've had guests on from them, and they have another film coming up. Actually, it's running right now through tomorrow. It's called Into the Weeds. And you can get all the information about how to sign up for this free screening at home, sustainablewoodstock.org. And just a brief blurb about it. Does the most widely used weed killer in the world cause cancer? Into the Weeds, this film, follows the riveting story of groundskeeper Lee Johnson and his fight for justice against agrochemical giant fill-in-the-blank, of course, Monsanto, which is now called Bayer, the manufacturer of Roundup herbicides. So once again, check it out at sustainablewoodstock.org. As far as EVs, Henry, Bethel, which has a very active energy committee, they brought a proposal to their select board recently. Josh Wardell from the energy committee there in Bethel came to explain his research on area charging rates for EV chargers. The vendor that he is recommending uses a 3-year contract. Board members expressed their concerns, such as the fact that this adds more weight to the loads of overwhelmed workers. After some discussion, sounds like it was going to be voted down. Nope, they decided to purchase the proposed EV charger. So I'll be curious to check that out when it gets installed in Bethel. I'll just mention one EV that I noticed that I sort of heard rumors about, but I saw one here in town. A lot of people have been asking for years, where is Subaru? You know, the most popular car for several years now, all-wheel drive in this very muddy and often snowy state. Well, not as much snow, more mud these days. Well, they have come out with a car called the Subaru Solterra, S-O-L-T-E-R-R-A. I won't get into the weeds about all the specs on it, but an all-wheel drive sort of SUV is joining the growing list of EV options. And now I think that goes back to you, Henry.
Yes, so that Solterra sells for $44,945 basically, and you can lease it for $329 a month. But you can also lease a Kia Nitro electric for $149 a month. And you can lease a Hyundai Iroquois 5 or 6 for 189 or 199. So the sale price, lowest sale price, Nissan Leafs, $28,000 if you're buying it outright, and you can lease one of those for $179. So there are not all the EVs are crazy priced. And I've included a cheat sheet that shows you all these and shows the fuel efficiency of these different vehicles. So the miles per kilowatt varies almost from the top to the bottom of the entire chart. There's some that are twice as efficient as other ones, and that's probably somewhat to do with just out-and-out size. But it also is to do with efficiency. Some of them are more aerodynamic and more efficient and still have plenty of space in them. So there's a link to that in the links.
A link in the links. That's very good. And of course, we have had Drive Electric Vermont founder Dave Roberts on our show several times. Maybe I'll do a little research on the used EV market for our next show and let people know. I was asked by a friend of ours, Henry. We won't mention his name on the air, but he's an environmentalist, and they're looking into either getting a hybrid or an EV. And I was talking about various options and asking about driving habits, etc. But what I would say is that there is a growing market of used EVs that are very affordable, but check out your driving habits, etc. I'm going to shift gears now away from EVs and go to trails. A lot of us like to use our trails and Class 4 roads in, mostly in non-motorized fashion. And right here in the town of Royalton, there was a discussion of a wildcat trail. So one of the board members there, and for full disclosure, Tim Murphy, who is on the Royalton Select Board, is also a programmer here at Royalton Community Radio. You can hear him on Sunday mornings on One Planet Groove. And Tim heard from Bethel about establishing a wildcat trail around Class 4 Road TH number 21. The board thought they might wait to see how it turns out in Tunbridge with the trail designation. So there are two towns sitting on a decision based on an ongoing dispute in our hometown of Tunbridge. And just to let folks know, if you want to get the update on that, the Tunbridge Select Board will be discussing the ongoing legal action and maybe possible decisions going forward. This coming Tuesday, probably in the first hour, if you go to the town of Tunbridge and look under the Select Board, you can zoom in and get the latest scoop. Back to you, Henry. We're listening to a little bit of music from Doug Perkins, and he is appearing with the Hot Pickin' Party up at Braintree this weekend as part of their Braintree Brunch. They'll start playing music up there at the Braintree Town Hall, or a historic building up there on the ridge, starting at noon this coming Sunday.
Yeah. So I'd just like to put a request in again. I'm not hearing back from listeners, but for you people, what do you want to hear more about? What do you want to us to dig into? This show tends to wander in the direction that I'm currently thinking about. And we try to mix it up some, but we're happy to do things that you'd like to know more about.
Well, you're the driving wheel, Henry. We need you to keep that renewable energy, keep the wheel turning. But we could use a lot of input to keep it turning even faster out there. So how do people get a hold of you about that, Henry?
Well, they could email me. I'd be very pleased to have emails. I'll put that in the links.
Okay.
But it's henrysuaze@gmail.com, all run together.
Yeah. Easy to spell. SWAYZE. henrysuaze@gmail.com.
That's the hard part. There's three spellings for Swayze.
I think I got the right one. All right, let's folks know about who keeps this type of programming on the air, keeps you updated on all things environmental, renewable, and sustainable. That is our show, Green Zine, brought to you today by Bale, Solaflect, Royal Trail Works, Daniel Leibowitz, Upper Pass Beer Company, First Branch Coffee Company, Solar Fest, White River Land Collaborative, Wit and Grit. And it's quite possible that Henry will be flying solo next week here from the studio, and you will have a guest. You mentioned that guest one more time for next week, Henry.
Yes. I can't.
Well, they just called back, but the subject matter.
Yes, so we're looking at the New England grid, how to make it greener, and how public can get involved in pushing to make that happen.
Okay, I'll try to listen from afar. Hey, thanks for joining us today, and stay tuned for Democracy Now! Here at WFBRLP South Royalton. See you, Henry.
See ya.